Today, consumer lending reprieve against chaotic data. The DFA Daily to the 17th of March 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's post, I'm going to discuss the latest home price trends, risky mortgage lending, the things people are doing to get bigger loans, and the impact of job seeker closing at the end of March, as well as looking at mortgage delinquency and business failures. So plenty to talk about. Let's get started. And of course, the big news is that the Responsible Lending Repeal Bill, which was due to go into Parliament and be voted on this week, has been put back until May. And the reason for that is that the Senate numbers wouldn't pass the bill, which is good news. It means that the opposition parties and crossbenches are actually waking up to what this bill is really about. Now, whether it will come back in May or not, we'll see. But at least for now, consumers are still protected thanks to the responsible lending obligations. Now, turning to residential property prices, they experienced strong growth at the end of last year, according to the most recent figures from the ABS. They reveal that residential property prices rose 3% in the December 2020 quarter from the last quarter, and that's the strongest quarterly growth since the quarter of December 2019. The ABS said the price growth was led by Sydney up 3% and Melbourne up 3.4%, followed by Canberra up 3.4%, Hobart up 3.1%, Perth up 2.9%, Brisbane up 2.7%, Adelaide up 2.6%, and Darwin up 2.2%. Meanwhile, on an annual basis, residential property prices in capital cities rose 3.6% in the December quarter from the same period in 2019, with Hobart seeing the biggest rise, up 6.4%, followed by Canberra up 5.2% and Perth up 4.2%. The ABS said that the growth in property prices is consistent with a range of housing market indicators, new lending commitments to households, auction clearance rates, and days on market all improved during the December quarter. They didn't, of course, mention the rate cuts and the incentives to borrow more, but that's another story. And the ABS data also show that the total value of Australia's 10.6 million residential dwellings rose by $257.9 billion to $7.7 trillion in the December quarter of 2020. That's the strongest rise since the December quarter of 2016. So, folks, we are all feeling rich. Well, maybe, maybe not. And consequently, the ABS revalued the new mean price of residential dwellings in Australia to be $728,500. But of course, that is not equally spread across the country. But despite a surging mortgage market, bank profits dropped by over a third in the calendar year 2020, according to new APRA data. The APRA data was released via the quarterly authorised depositing institutions data and the property exposures data to December 2020. According to the data, the banking sector's collective net profit after tax was $21.9 billion in the year ending December 2020. That's down a massive 35% on the year December 2019. The APRA figures reveal that the banking sector suffered greatly in the first quarter of the calendar year, following Christmas and the beginning of the COVID-19 period, returning a net profit after tax of just $1.5 billion. In the same period the year prior, they returned a profit of $6.8 billion, but profits picked up to $7 billion in the June 2020 period, and then dropped to $3.6 billion in the September quarter. And in the final quarter of the year, which is typically one of the most profitable for the sector, the bank saw a net profit of $9.7 billion, bringing the total for the year to $21.9 billion. APRA said the total assets grew over the year, with banks now holding assets worth more than $5 trillion for the first time. And as of December 2020, banks held $5.3 trillion in total assets, up 6.4% on the previous year. But despite this, profits were hit after total operating income, return on assets after tax, and return on equity after tax all dropped on the previous year, while operating expenses increased to $58 billion. The total impaired facilities also rose over the year, rising from $12.9 billion in the year to December 2019 to $14.6 billion in the year to December 2020. And APRA found that impaired assets and past due items rose 17.1% in the year, from $31 billion as at December 2019 to $36.4 billion a year later. However, the Prudential regulator noted that repayment deferrals may have dulled the anticipated deterioration in asset quality. And looking at the banking sector's total loans for the final 3 months of the year, the total amount of owner-occupied credit outstanding in December 2020 totaled $1.17 trillion, up 6.9% on a year earlier. Investment lending credit was 1% lower compared with 2019 to $609.6 billion. And non-performing term loans held by the banks were up 19.2% to $18.8 billion, while interest-only loans dropped 10.4%. And in terms of new loans funded over the period, owner-occupied loans increased by 23.6% on the December 2019 quarter at just under $89 billion. And new investment loans, which were funded, were up on the previous period, rising 13.7% to $36.4 billion. And the value of new interest-only loans funded also increased markedly on the previous year, growing from $18.7 billion in December to $24.6 billion in December 2020. Third-party originated loans were up a massive 28% on December 2020 quarter, writing $69.5 billion in new loans in the quarter, up from $54.3 billion at the same period a year earlier. And APRA said that the ADI industry was resilient in the December quarter, with high capital ratios and strong liquidity and funding positions. Industry profitability improved over the quarter due to reduced charges for bad and doubtful debts, and overall growth in loans and advances was slow, although housing lending grew moderately, supported by lending to owner-occupiers. They went on to say, despite moderately increasing new lending at higher loan-to-value ratios and debt-to-income ratios, available indicators do not suggest any material relaxation in housing lending standards, with these metrics remaining broadly in line with historical averages. Key measures of asset quality were stable thanks to a range of measures providing support to borrowers, but the outlook is uncertain as support measures change over the coming quarters. Or in other words, APRA is acknowledging that there is an extend and pretend in place at the moment. You can't run on the figures because they're not telling you the true story. But I think UBS got a much better sense of what's going on. They said that higher risk home loans increased significantly in the fourth quarter across debt to income ratios, loan to value ratios, and the interest only shares. They previously argued that macroprudential policy tightening by the regulators via the Council of Financial Regulators, which of course includes APRA and the RBA, it's chaired by the RBA and is really Philip Lowe's other brain, in my view, is just a matter of timing. And instead, of course, of perhaps lifting rates. Indeed, the Council of Financial Regulators said they are watching housing and will continue to closely monitor developments, but they added, and consider possible responses should lending standards deteriorate and financial risks increase. Furthermore, RBA Governor Lowe added that they are watching carefully for changes in lending standards. Now, I think the data on home loans, as shown in the quarter-on-quarter figures, is showing higher risk loans rising, and given the further pickup of home loans and prices in the first quarter, this trend is actually about a rising share. Looking specifically in the fourth quarter, the share of new home loans with a high debt-to-income ratio lifted to a record high of 59.3% from 57.7%, and that included very high debt-to-income ratios at 6 times or more, up to a record high of 16.9% from 16%. Similarly, high LVR loans, greater than 80%, spiked to a record high of 42% from 39.9%. The interest rate paid on home loans ticked down to under 3%, but the assessment rate dropped to 5.5%, and banks reported a further large decline in the first quarter towards 5%. This is very sharply increasing borrowing capacity and seeing a large rise in average loan sizes, and UBS estimates a return to an interest rate floor of closer to 6% may be considered as more prudent and would reduce borrowing capacity by 10 to 15%. Such a change would take a lot of heat out of the housing market. Interest-only home loans picked up to 19.3% from 18.7%. That's the highest ratio since the second quarter 2019, albeit still well below the prior 30% cap and further below the prior cycle peak of around 40%. And finally, the share of loans approved outside serviceability fell back further to a low 3.2%, but that more likely reflects an easing of the serviceability policies, i.e. meaning a lower share were outside criteria rather than the tightening of lending standards. Now, the RBA's March minutes argued that lending standards remain sound and that it was important that they should remain so in an environment of rising house prices and low interest rates. The board concluded that there were greater benefits for financial stability from a stronger economy while acknowledging the importance of closely monitoring risks in asset markets. UBS said, "We think a further increase in high-risk home lending ahead would challenge this RBA view, but they also think the timing of the macroprudential tightening is probably still only later in the year, with data needed to assess the impact of the end of JobKeeper and, of course, the home builder stimulus too. Yet, the spruiking for more assistance to kick the housing market along just continues, with Tim Wilson leading off again about using super to buy a home. In fact, the federal government is being urged to commission an independent review into housing affordability against the backdrop of calls from some backbench MPs that superannuation savings should be used to buy a home. Analysis by the Association of Superannuation Funds of Australia found that using super for housing would, quote, put significant pressure on home prices and would only exacerbate housing affordability concerns. Now, you could argue they've got an axe to grind too, of course. The ASFA CEO, Martin Fay, said Australia already has some of the most expensive housing in the world, and using super housing deposits would be disastrous and push prices even further out of reach of first-time buyers. He blamed a lack of supply and policy settings with respect to residential investment property for the distortionary effect on demand. These are the real issues that must be tackled to generate improvements in housing affordability, he said. And he said using retirement savings for housing deposits is fundamentally inconsistent with the objectives of superannuation to provide an adequate retirement income. None of the comprehensive reviews of superannuation over the last decade have recommended it, while several have made recommendations to the contrary, he said. And the ASFA recommends that the federal government commissions a comprehensive and independent review of housing affordability to establish a fact base and drive sensible, consistent policy across federal, state and local governments. Well, that would be a first, wouldn't it? And former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has also said allowing people to withdraw from their retirement savings to help buy a house is, quote, the craziest idea I've heard, and lashed out at politicians for being patronising by denying ordinary Australians an increase in the superannuation rate. Last Friday, at an event organised by the industry Super Australia, Turnbull also took aim at really poor arguments against raising the super contribution rate from the current 9.5% that have been advanced by what he called former colleagues of mine, for whom I have respect and affection. The Victorian backbencher Tim Wilson has campaigned for super to be cracked open so that people can buy houses under the slogan Home First, Super Second, promising Australians they will have a better life and a better retirement. But Turnbull said Australia had a housing affordability problem, and allowing money to flow out of super accounts and into property would simply make it worse. Diverting even more savings into housing will simply just be going to bid up the price of housing, he said. I mean, that is honestly, that's the worst possible argument. The rate at which employers contribute to super is legislated to increase from 9.5% to 10% in July this year, before rising to 12% by 2025. But Wilson and other backbenchers have campaigned against the increase. They've claimed that super increases come out of wages, a claim that is supported by some economists but disputed by others and dismissed by the former Prime Minister Paul Keating, who introduced compulsory superannuation in 1992. Politicians and public servants have a compulsory 15.4% super contribution that was determined presumably a very long time ago because it was felt that that was an appropriate level to provide sufficient savings for retirement, Turnbull said. So is isn't it somewhat at odds, somewhat patronising, for people who benefit from 15.4% super to say that working people should be, should you know, settle for 9.5%? An Industry Super Australia's event marked the launch of a report, the body commissioned from the economist Asel Allen, on the effect of increasing the super guarantee rate as planned on the Australian economy. He said increasing the rate will increase GDP by about $12 billion a year by 2040, contrary to much of what has been said in the public debates on the rise of the superannuation guarantee rate. Apart from a very small and very short-lived effect, there is no trade-off between higher superannuation contributions and higher wages, the report said. In fact, an increase in the super guarantee rate, because it will lead to more capital accumulation in a bigger economy, will lead to higher real wages. But Australians are taking novel steps to try to borrow for a home without spending years saving up for a traditional mortgage deposit as property prices surge. With house values at record highs across most of the country, getting a home is harder than ever as prices continue to surge in the low interest rate environment. That has created a greater popularity of something called debt recycling, which allows someone who already is paying off a mortgage to borrow up to 80% of the value of their house or apartment if they can demonstrate that they could meet their repayment obligations. Bank recycling enables homeowners to borrow against the equity, the amount they already have paid off on their mortgage, to take out yet another loan to buy an investment property which can be rented out. Now, Michael Yardley, the Uber property bull and the director of Metropole Property Strategists, is advocating debt recycling as a good way to make money, provide a borrower's second loan is used to buy an appreciating asset. Reborrowing or recycling these funds mean you now have, quote, good debt, because you can use this to buy an appreciating asset that will bring in cash flow every month, he said. But AMP said borrowing against the equity in your home could leave a homeowner facing ruin should their second property go down in value or struggle to find a tenant. Debt recycling is considered a high-risk strategy because you're using borrowed money to invest and using your own home to secure that debt, it said. If your investment performs poorly or interest rates increase, you could face significant financial stress or even put your family home at risk. Now, of course, the Reserve Bank has vowed to keep interest rates at a record low of 0.1% until 2024, but that doesn't mean banks can't raise their standard variable mortgage rates before then. If the interest rate on your loan isn't fixed, a rise in interest rates can lead to your repayments increasing, AMP said. This can put pressure on your cash flow, which can be compounded further if the income from your investment is lower than expected. So Yardley's approach, in my view, is nutty at the moment, given the frothy nature of the market and the very low interest rates. And I really think that he should be much more cautious than he is about advocating this strategy, because a number of people will get sucked in and may well catch a cold later. And talking of catching a cold, Westpac reported their leading indicator eased back compared with last time, although they're still very bullish on the economy, saying that the growth rate in the index continues to hold comfortably in positive territory, which indicates that growth through much of 2021 will be above trend. They actually lifted their growth forecast for 2021 to 4.5% from 4%, which is well above trend. The key driver of growth in 2021 will be the household sector, as a sharp fall in the currently evaluated savings rates will free up considerable funds to support strong consumer spending, they said. Accumulated savings from 2020 will allow households to lower their savings rate, but that will only happen if there is a desire to lift spending. 10-year highs in the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of consumer sentiment, supplemented by a booming housing market and further reopening of the domestic economy as vaccine rollouts take effect, will, they say, set the scene for the expected boost in spending. That will be despite a modest contraction in real household disposable income as the withdrawal of government support programs and modest wages growth weighs on incomes. With the economy only contracting by 1.1% in 2020, the strong 1.6% growth we expect in the March quarter, they said, which is consistent with the signals from the leading index in the second half of 2020, will see activity returning to pre-pandemic levels during the March quarter. Over the last 6 months, the growth rate in the index has lifted from minus 0.2% to 2.64%. And they went on to say that the recovery in the growth rate continues to be dominated by international factors, US industrial production and commodity prices. Of the 2.84 percentage point recovery in the index, US industrial production actually contributed 1.2 percentage points, while commodity prices contributed 1.01 percentage points, and other positive contributors were hours worked, 0.72 percentage points, dwelling approvals 0.4 percentage points, and the yield curve 0.04%. Offsetting those gains was the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Expectations Index, down 0.2 percentage points. The Westpac Melbourne Institute Unemployment Expectation Index, down 0.14 percentage points. And the ASX S&P 200, down 0.13 percentage points. And they said the Reserve Bank Board meets next on April the 6th, and policy expected to remain on hold for the next few months before the board decides whether to extend its yield curve control policy to a longer bond than the current April 2024 bond. Westpac expects that the bank's forecast for inflation, wages growth and the unemployment rate will not make a credible case that by the first half of 2024 the economy will reach the conditions necessary to justify a rate increase. Accordingly, there will be full justification, they say, for the board extending the targeting program to the November bond, signalling that on current forecasts, the bank does not expect to be raising the cash rate until very late in 2024 at the earliest. Although I have a feeling that banks may start out of cycle increases before that. Nevertheless, it's also worth reflecting on this. The number of Australian workers that receive JobKeeper has continued to drop ahead of the scheme coming to an end next month. New figures from the ATO show that 1.54 million employees collected the wage subsidy between October and December last year, compared to 3.6 million between April and September. Western Australia, Northern Territory and South Australia reported the largest percentage of workers coming off the payment. Victoria had the smallest drop and still has the largest number of people on JobKeeper at 626,000 due to the long lockdown during the winter of last year. JobKeeper was set to end last year before the government extended the support but cut the fortnightly rate and tightened the eligibility. Treasury initially estimated that there will be 2.2 million workers on the payments in the December quarter. However, the latest data from the ATO is better than expected. In October, there were 1.63 million workers that received JobKeeper, and that dropped to 1.6 million in November before it dipped further to 1.54 million by the end of December. About 87% of those workers took home the top payment rate of $1,200 a fortnight. That payment has dropped to $1,000 a fortnight since January, but the data on how many people received the support is not yet available. Josh Frydenberg has used the figures to back the government's decision to end JobKeeper on March the 28th. These improvements have been broad-based across the country, he said, and we have seen encouraging signs across all sectors. While some industries have bounced back since the height of the pandemic, others are still struggling to find their feet. The ATO figures show that the number of workers on JobKeeper in retail dropped by 68%, while transport, postal and warehousing still struggled, with only a 36% drop in the number of people on the wage subsidy. There is no data for the tourism sector as a whole because the industry covers a wide range of jobs, from tour operators to cafes. However, accommodation and food services reported a 52% drop in the number of people on JobKeeper, and the Treasurer pointed to figures from some key tourist markets to show improvements have been made, such as a 55% drop of workers on the wage subsidy in Cairns and a 59% reduction on the Gold Coast. Our economic recovery plan will continue to support the economy through measures such as tax cuts, business incentives, the job maker hiring credit, and a record investment in skills and training, Frydenberg said. But sectors that rely on the international market, such as aviation and tourism, have asked the federal government for additional help past the March cut-off, and we saw some of that with the airline tickets. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said recently that the JobKeeper programme could and would not remain in place forever. The whole point of these programmes, whether it's JobKeeper, whether it's HomeBuilder, whether it's the COVID supplement on JobSeeker, all of these were designed as temporary, targeted, proportionate measures. Heard that before. To stand in the gap during the crisis and then enable the recovery of the economy to stand on its own two feet. And the Secretary of the Treasury Department, Dr. Stephen Kennedy, said on Thursday that he expected some people would be let go when the wage subsidy scheme ended. I'd expect it will mean that there are some people whose employment won't be present. Job losses will be coming, he told a parliamentary hearing that has been examining the government's response to COVID-19. But he could not put a figure on how many jobs will be lost. Others are suggesting a minimum of 100,000, maybe up to 250 to 300,000. However, he said that the economy is recovering faster than what we anticipated, and he expects the number of people working will increase as restrictions ease and the vaccination rollout begins. For those without work, the federal government is yet to decide what the ongoing rate of job seeker will be past March the 31st. But that said, there was another construction company failure announced as GW Civil Contracting went into liquidation, owing creditors $3.1 million after COVID-19 delayed projects, and it lost its JobKeeper eligibility. The liquidator said that larger companies have been putting pressure on margins and it was more challenging to win work. I think we're going to see more of those. And mortgage defaults are set to surge by the middle of this year, despite interest rates being at a record low of just 0.1%, says the Daily Mail. Credit ratings agency Moody Investor Services is predicting an increase in home loan arrears in the first half of 2021 as borrowers struggle to cope with the end of six-month repayment holidays during the COVID-19 lockdowns and the phasing out of JobKeeper wage subsidies. Delinquencies, where borrowers are at least 30 days behind on their repayments, fell at the end of 2020, but were expected to deteriorate in the first half of 2021 due to the uneven economic recovery and the end of government and lending support measures. The $1,000 a fortnight job keep-away subsidy for full-time workers at businesses that suffered as a result of the lockdowns, of course, are ending on March the 28th. Just 3 days after that, the $150 coronavirus supplement is ending for those on JobSeeker unemployment benefits. In this environment, mortgage delinquencies will increase over the first half of 2021, particularly when borrowers have to resume repayments after loan deferral periods, Moody said. The rise in mortgage delinquencies for borrowers at 30, 60 and 90 days behind on their repayments might be offset by an increase in home prices, with CoreLogic data showing records in February were set in 53 of Australia's 88 submarkets. The rising prices allowed those struggling with mortgages to sell their homes, pay off the bank and still pocket a profit. Rising house prices will curb mortgage delinquencies risks to some extent, because they will make it easier for borrowers in financial difficulty to sell their properties and repay loans, Moody said. But the positive influence of rising house prices will not be enough to prevent delinquency rates from increasing in the first half of 2021. The unevenness of the economic recovery was shown by the 11.6% drop in the number of payroll jobs in the hospitality sector at the end of February compared with mid-March 2020, shortly before the COVID shutdowns. That was significantly worse than the average drop of 0.2% across all industries, the ABS revealed recently. And Moody's expect the rate of mortgage defaults and delinquencies to fall again in the second half of 2021 as the economy recovers. Towards the end of 2021, as the economic recovery gathers momentum, we expect the situation to turn around and for delinquency rates to improve, he said. And meantime, Commonwealth Bank, Australia's biggest home lender, revealed on Tuesday a record level of home buying intentions. Mortgage applications and Google searches in February were at the highest level since the monthly household spending intention data series began in 2015. In December, 1.44% of loans with a major bank were 30 days or more behind with repayments, compared to 1.69% in June 2020. As Australia slipped into recession for the first time in 29 years, Moody's data on mortgage securities showed. But there's a couple of points here, of course. The mortgage-backed security data pools have been contaminated because we know that a number of banks bought back bad loans out of those pools when they shouldn't have. And we also know that a lot of people are still getting support on their mortgages and that the mortgage repayment holidays will not end until the end of March. So we are boxing at shadows a bit in terms of trying to get a read on what the real delinquency rate is. And I'll just remind you again that my mortgage stress data is showing that more than 1.5 million households are in financial strife on a cash flow basis. And I expect that to get worse, not better, as the JobKeeper program ends and as more people are falling back on their own savings or borrowing more or trying to find other ways to make their mortgage repayments. And so if we stand back, we can see that there are some further contradictory signs with home prices moving away, high-risk lending definitely increasing, and a risk of more moving into default. So trying to get a read on where the economy is going from this point is, well, challenging. But we'll try to do that and report next month with some revised scenarios. Meantime, I just caution people to be a little bit cautious about not getting into too much debt in the current uncertain times that we're in. Because the truth is that the degree of uncertainty and the number of unknown unknowns is probably higher than it's ever been. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.